G'day, I am Mordechai Becher, and this is
Two Rabbis and a Podcast, and I am Yehoshua Karsh.
And we are going to be talking about Pesach, Passover, Chag HaMatzot, Festival of Matzahs. We've spoken about music, two parts on music, music in Judaism. We spoke about free will. We spoke about vengeance. We spoke about literalism in the Torah, literalism in the Midrash. We spoke about, what else did we speak about?
We spoke about free will twice.
Okay. And so it is.
We spoke about Purim.
Yes, Purim. We spoke about Purim. Exactly. And now we're going to talk about Pesach. We're not exactly sure what we're going to talk about in terms of Pesach, because Pesach is vast. First and foremost, thing that stands out about Passover, the Exodus, etc., is that is how God, Hashem, introduces himself to the world, to the Jewish people, not to the world, but to the Jewish people at the first of the Aseret Hadibrois, the Ten Commandments. He says, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. And as Ibn Ezra and Rubin Alevi point out, he does not say, I am God who created space, time, matter. He doesn't say, I'm God who created the universe. He says, I'm God who took you out of Egypt. That's significant. And numerous reasons have been given. First of all, creation is for everyone. God's creating a covenant with the Jewish people specifically. The Exodus was the creation for the Jewish people. And so therefore, he talks about the Exodus. The other answer, which I think Rabbi Yehuda Levi gives, is that no one can possibly relate to or even imagine creation. But everyone can relate to getting out of suffering, getting out of slavery, released from bondage, etc. That's something that people could relate to. It happened to these people who God was talking to. And even later generations, we can relate to it. We can understand it. Our imagination can conceive of it.
I think, doesn't he even say, like, we weren't at creation? We experienced Yetzias Mitzrayim, but we didn't experience, we weren't at that beginning, at the creation.
Correct. We are witnesses. We were witnesses because it happened to us. Yeah. No one witnessed creation. So I did hear once, I hesitate to even say his name, but Rabbi Sachs, I love Hashalom, because I just don't, I love him, but I don't want to start something. But so Rabbi Sachs,
reference but, one of the earlier podcasts, if you want
to. Yes, yeah, reference. Mechila Real. Okay. Anyway, yes. But Rabbi Sachs once said that God wants us to, when he says, I am God, part of what he means is, I want you to imitate me. So I can't imitate God as creator of heaven and earth, but we can imitate God as one who takes people out of suffering, one who redeems those who are oppressed. Very beautiful thought.
Yes.
And
I once asked Ramosha Shapiro, blessed memory, that, you know, at the beginning of the Kuzari, so the way the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Levi makes his point is that the king of the Khazars is looking for, he has this dream that his heart's in the right place, but his actions are not, and he's trying to resolve that. He's trying to find, you know, the proper way. So he interviews the Christians, he interviews the Muslims, he interviews the philosophers, and then he interviews the Jew. And this is the introduction of the relationship between him, the chaver, the Jew, and the king. And so he asks the king, like, what do you believe? You know, tell me about your belief. So the king says we believe in the God who took us out of Egypt with signs.
The rabbi says, yeah.
I mean, the chaver. Yeah, the chaver, not the king. We're, I believe in the God who took us out of Egypt with signs and wonders, took us across the sea and brought us to Har Sinai, gave us the Mon, you know, and this is the same God who created the universe in 6 days and rested on the seventh, something like that. So the king of the Khazars says to him, you know, I wasn't going to talk to the Jews because you're a pitiful looking people, and I couldn't imagine that you could have the truth. And now that I've actually spoken to you, I think I'm probably right. Because that he's, and he's, let me just help you a little bit. If you believe in the God who created the universe, start with that. That's your big thing. Why
that's more impressive.
Right. More impressive than he took us out of Egypt. And then his response was that, you know, we were there. And you know, and he said, well, the things that you said, but this notion of this experience is different to us than creation, because we were there. We experienced it personally. We heard about creation and we believe everything about it. In fact, going out of Egypt showed us that the truth of that statement, but it's much different when you've experienced it, something like that, or you know, you're told about it. So I asked her, Moshe, I said, that's fine for the people that left Mitzrayim, but for me, I'm 3,300 years away from that. For me, Yetzias Mitzrayim is not much different than Brias HaOlam. I hear about both of them through the same book. And it's very, you know, it's so distant from me. So he like looks at me and he said, it isn't true, even for you. He said, we were changed by that experience. And you carry that with you. It doesn't matter, it was 3,000 years ago. You're a part of Klal Yisrael. The Jewish people had this experience. It impacted us. And you carry on that same experience. You may not think it's different, you know, when you're just superficially thinking about it, but you if you could sort of like be in touch, it seemed like, you see, if I could be in touch with the depths of my spirit, I would see that I'm still impacted by it, just like they were impacted by it, like 3,000 years ago.
Well, to continue and expand on what Rav just said, I think part of it is that, first of all, there's one distinction is that the Exodus was part of human experience. Creation was not, right? So that means it is something much more relatable than creation, concrete, defined within the framework of human experience, human history. So I can imagine and relate to it much better than to creation. Yeah. Not just much better, I think qualitatively speaking, I cannot relate to creation at all. But based on what Rav Moshe said, I think you look through the Chumash, and I put just a bunch of places, the entire Jewish attitude to the world, so much of it has been shaped by the Exodus, even to this very day. So, example, Shmot, Exodus 22. Do not oppress the stranger, because you were strangers in Egypt. The Jewish attitude to the other, the philanthropy, etc. I mean, that's part of it. Shmot 23, we are told that returning lost property, helping someone who's in trouble, do not take a bribe, do not oppress people. You were strangers in Egypt. The Torah continuously refers back to this. Vayikra, Leviticus 19. When a stranger lives amongst you, love him. Love him because you were strangers. You were in Egypt. Do not oppress people using false weights and measures. Don't rip people off. Why? I'm God who took you out of Egypt. Just one after the other. I think I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I don't know. Something like 15 or so places in the five books of Moses, Torah, where the Torah associates various commandments that talk about justice towards other people, that talk about charity, philanthropy, helping people, so don't oppress people, and so on, always referring back to Egypt. There's type of like an Exodus attitude that we have. Now, obviously, there are exceptions. But, you know, in terms of the general Jewish philanthropy is something which is incredible. Throughout history, you know, in I seem to remember talking about this, there's a study of the Jews in medieval Rome. There were something like less than 3,000 Jews there, and there was something like 20 different charitable funds. There was a fund for Jews in Israel. There was a fund for people who were sick. There was a fund for visitors. There was a fund for marrying off poor brides. There was a fund for burial. There was a fund for Torah scholars. There was a fund. There was like in London, you know, half the in 18th, 19th century, half the population of the Jewish population lived under the poverty line, and they were supported by the other half of the Jewish population who lived above the poverty line.
So, how are you connecting this to Yitzhak?
I think that attitude comes from Egypt. The recognizing of someone who's oppressed, I think that comes from the fact that we've had Egypt, you know, beaten into our heads for so many years. I mean, in a pleasant way, I think that has created that type of philanthropy. I think there was some study in Johns Hopkins about philanthropy with the ethnic group with the greatest philanthropy in the United States. I think it was the Jews, not just the Jewish causes.
Right.
We live in religious Jewish communities. I sometimes tell people there's such a thing as gemach. What's a gemach? As a gemach, someone who invests money in buying tables and chairs, advertises that they're available to borrow. So people borrow them for all types of things. Someone invests in power tools, right? And I would never lend out my power tools. I mean, they are.
You wouldn't lend out anything. I remember one moment.
I have lent out books,
but I would like to recall a moment that is a treasured moment for me, which is that Mordechai loves his sfarim, and he loves his books, and he takes really good care of them, and it's almost like anything that happens to his sfarim, it's happening to, you know, it's like one of those voodoo dolls. Like if somebody pricks the doll, it like hurts the person. So if something would happen, you could see the look.
Like a street youth in his car.
Right. Yes. So what Ramosha was giving a sheer Chloe, and it must have been your Gemara, I don't know, or was a Rishon or something. He borrowed it from you because he needed to use it for the sheer Chloe. And I remember he opened it and bent it, and you could hear the spine cracking.
I could hear it.
And Mordechai was in such pain. Anyways,
it could be that Ramosha did it deliberately in order for me to overcome.
Yes, he wanted you natural, to pass.
To educate me. I don't know. That was a painful moment. Yes.
Could I mention something also? Yeah. An experience I had. I had this experience maybe 10, 12 years ago. There were a couple people who started something called the Jewish Studies, Jewish Learning at DePaul University. DePaul in Chicago is a Catholic. I mean, there's DePaul's in other places, but it's a Catholic university. But there were a couple professors in the law school who decide, you know, there's a lot of Jewish people that go there. They decided to start like a Jewish studies kind of thing. It was mostly, it wasn't a Jewish studies department, but they would have events and things like that where people could get together. So somehow they got a gigantic grant to do this, and I was invited to it. I knew both the professors, Roberta Kual and Shlomo Chaim Reznikov. And I also knew there was a woman who was like the administrator, Galit Gottlieb. So they put together the most remarkable day. It was professors from universities around the United States who teach the American Constitution. The United States Constitution. So, and we're talking Harvard, Yale, Berkeley, University of Chicago, any like the finest universities, and even some of the, you know, more pedestrian universities. But it was like a who's who of people that taught it, not just Jewish people that taught it. It was a who's who of people that teach the Constitution. And they're all like in one room, like, and, you know, there were different people giving lectures at different times, but there were some moments where everybody was together. And one of the questions they were asked and was, is there anything about your Jewish upbringing that you think contributes to the way you view the Constitution and the way you teach the Constitution?
Yeah, great question. Yeah.
And one after another said the Seder. We're talking about, there was a guy, a professor at Yale, who was the professor of many of these professors. He was like the professor's professor. And he's like originally from Kansas City. And he, you know, he got the ball rolling. And he said, when I was a kid, I, you know, and since I was a kid, every year we'd read the Haggadah, and this story of the Jewish people leaving Egypt to me was, you know, it was the lens at which I saw the freedom, and it's, and the founding fathers, you know, they themselves. Ooh.
It inspired, it has inspired reflection. Freedom movements around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Inspired people around the world. Yeah, it's really something. So yeah. It's had a profound impact on the Jewish people, on the whole world. And then if you go on to, let's say, Yirmiyahu and Micha, you know, you see very similar attitude, right? How the Exodus is supposed to shape our attitude to life in general, to people in general. So I think, to me, that's very, very, very profound, and it's encapsulated in that, you know, I am God who took you out of Egypt. That's right there. I think that's very significant. Yeah.
Lately I've had this thought. You know the smock that. Ramon Shalsa used to quote this smack on the first of the Aseret Dibros that you quoted. He says, "Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeicha me'eretz Mitzrayim mibeis avodim." I, the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from a house of slave, a house of bondage. So the smack, sefer mitzvos tanos, or cotton, says, that when you read that, you're supposed to understand. In other words, you're supposed to feel that just like he took us out of Mitzrayim back then, he's going to take us out of our exile now. In other words, it's like, this is how we're supposed to read it. Just like I took you out of Mitzrayim then, I'm going to take you out of the Golos. I'm going to give, there'll be salvation again. So,
well, your camera just went
so,
off.
So yeah, I got a call in the middle of that. So, so I was thinking that, I feel lately that it's possible that there are many of us who just don't believe it. That when we talk about Mashiach coming, or we talk about the possibility, I'm sorry, this keeps on happening, getting these phone calls in the middle. When we talk about Mashiach coming and we think about a salvation, that we talk about it, but we don't actually believe it could really happen. Like there was a movie called Hoosiers with Gene Hackman. It was about this small town high school basketball team that ends up in the state championships. And there's this scene where they're at the arena where they're going to play. They're there like the day before, and he takes them onto the court, and he asks one of the guys on the team to measure the distance between the floor and the rim. So he measures it and he goes, how high is it? He says 10 feet. You know, And then he points out that's exactly the same height as the rim in our court. And then he has them measure the other dimensions of the court and shows them that the dimensions are exactly the same as the court they've been playing in all year long and they've been winning on all year long. And he said, you have already won on this court. You have won on this court many times, and you're going to be playing on that same court tomorrow. You can win on that court. And so that in other words, that part of the purpose of remembering Mitzrayim, even part of the purpose of the Seder, is not simply so that we never forget the most remarkable moment in our history, but also so that we believe in the salvation to come. Lashana Haba, that's how we end it. Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. And for people like there, you know, for many of us, we just can't picture it. And maybe we have to, like, during the Seder or when we're remembering Mitzrayim, we need to have like one of those Hoosier moments, which is, you already did this once. This already happened once. We were there. And maybe getting an opportunity to relive how it went then it can then be that the foundation of our belief that it can happen again. Because if we don't believe it can happen again, that could get in the way of it happening again.
Well, the 2 points to make, and agreed 100%.
Yeah.
When some of the commentaries say that the reason it doesn't say I am God who created the world, but I am God who took you out of Egypt, because creation doesn't necessarily indicate continuous involvement. But the Exodus indicates God's continuous involvement and care and intimate knowledge of the world, number one. But number two, also, one of the points, and this is the Smak's point, and this is how Reb Moshe said it many times, is when Hashem said to Moshe, I will be what I will be.
Yeah.
Rashi comments on that as I was with you in this exile, I'll be with you in future exiles. So, commentary say, well, that's depressing. We're getting out of Egypt. Now we're talking about future exiles. But what Hashem is saying is this Egypt was not a one-time event. It's a guarantee that there'll never be an exile forever.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a redemption, right? Yeah. It's not going to be forever. And that's actually one of the answers, I believe, that I think maybe Reb Moshe gave. You know, the Ramban tells us, we just read Parshas HaChodesh on Shabbos, that this month shall be for you the first of month. Today is the first day of the month of Nisan, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. I should point out, it's my father, Oliver Sholem's Yortzeit, Shlomo Tzvi ben Mordechai. And so today, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. But Hashem says this will be the first month. So the Ramban points out that in the Chumash, in the five books of Moses, the months have no names. They've only got numbers. They're numbered as the month number one of the Exodus, number two of the Exodus, because you're supposed to always remember the Exodus. Every time I say, oh, it's the second month, third month, fourth month, fifth month, I'm referring back to the Exodus. Just like the days of the week don't have names in the Torah, in Hebrew, the only day of the week that has a name is Shabbos, Shabbat. Every other day of the week is Hayom Yom, Rishon B'Shabbat, the first day of Shabbat, the second. So we're remembering Shabbat. So if so, and he says, where do the names that we use for the month come from? As we know, they are Aramaic names that came from Babylon. And these Babylonian names were adopted by the Jews. And we now use the Babylonian names when we came back from Babylon. So the obvious question is, well, if there's this incredible mitzvah to always remember the Exodus from Egypt, and hence the Torah doesn't give names, how do we have the chutzpah to use names from Babylon? The Ramban alludes to this idea, but Reb Moshe said that because when we came out, when God took us out of Babylon, which actually was a result of Purim, we came back to the land of Israel, rebuilt the temple. We're there for another 420 years, right? Independent country, kings, and so on and so forth. So that was a fulfillment of the Exodus promise. So when we say Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, which are all Babylonian names, we're reminding ourselves that, you know what? God did not just take us out of Egypt. He took us out of Babylon. And just like he took us out of Babylon, he'll take us out of wherever we are. So it's something that's a reminder that it's a continuous promise. So yeah, we should, it's nothing wrong with using those names. They're used in the first time, I think, in Megillas Esther. But those names remind us of that promise that there'll be. And yeah, you're right. I think people have a hard time. One way I look at it is, if you would have told, someone actually said, I once took two people to Israel, two very wealthy people.
Yeah.
So they asked, so they had me do a tour of Israel. But one of them was a hedge fund guy who's one of his clients, fabulously, the hedge fund guy was religious. His client was secular. He wanted to show him Israel. So the three of us went to Israel together.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah. It was not a private jet, if I remember correctly.
No, it was not. Actually, one of them was surprised, but it was El Al first class, which was phenomenal. Breakfast buffet, and it was like incredible. Anyway, so we get to Israel, and we went to meet a politician whose name eludes me. I'm sorry. We went to meet this famous politician who had been brought up on a non-religious kibbutz on the shores of the Kinneret, completely left-wing socialist kibbutz, was a special forces commander during the first and second Lebanon War, became religious, went to yeshiva, got rabbinic ordination, et cetera, et cetera. Amazing, amazing fellow. He's no longer in politics, and I haven't lost track of him. But so we met with him. So this non-religious guy said, he says, if I'd see a miracle, he says, you know, I'd be more inclined to believe in the Torah, et cetera. So the guy said, look at me. I said, what do you mean? He said, if you would have told my great-grandparents who lived in Lithuania, you would say they'd go to Madame Zelda for a future fortune-telling. She says, I see, right? She says, I see that in 100 years you will have a child who will be a commander in a Jewish army, Hebrew-speaking Jewish army in the land of Israel. Right? They would say, very funny. He says, and not only that, he will have a degree in economics from a Hebrew-speaking university in the port of Haifa in the north of Israel. And not only that, you'll have a descendant who will have rabbinic ordination from a yeshiva of 800 people in the city of Jerusalem. And in the city of Jerusalem, and that you'll also have a great grandson who will be a member of a Jewish parliament in Israel, in the state of Israel, in the land ancient. They'd say, you're nuts. It says, and then Madame Zelda would say, oh, by the way, they're all the same person. It's all me. Degree in economics. He's got smicha, right? Commander of special forces. This is unbelievable stuff, right? So a Jew with faith a few hundred years ago, you would have told me, it must be Mashiach.
Right.
And if you look in the Rambam, although there is, you know, a lot of things are not totally clear, but the Rambam Maimonides seems to understand that the Mashiach is not necessarily in a supernatural way. There are events that will move it towards that. Events happening in the natural world. Okay. And the very fact, like, for example, that Rabbi Akiva and most of the sages, or all, that's debatable, but many, many sages, and certainly Rabbi Akiva, believed that Bar Kochva was possibly the Mashiach.
Yeah.
Right? Here he is. He's a Jewish king. He successfully defended the Jews against their enemies. He set up a Jewish, you know, sovereignty, minting coins and so on and so forth. And he's a righteous person. We have actually archaeological evidence. And so, makes sense. They didn't ask him to do miracles, etc. There's, you know, he didn't perform any miracles. Eventually he failed. Okay. But they thought this may be it. So here we have today. It's very hard to dismiss the fact that there are millions of Jews living in our ancestral land in Israel, for Jews from all over the world, Jews from, you know, from Albania and Austria, and you know, I mean, go to the Kosel, Western Wall, you'll see Jews of all types, all over the place, right? The country has problems. I'm not saying it's perfect.
Yeah.
But millions of Jews speaking Hebrew, living in our ancestral land, planting vineyards, and you know, the whole work, that's pretty wild. That's shocking. Yeah. And that it's very hard not to have faith.
That's a living miracle.
Well, when you see all that,
right?
It's hard not to. There's a great story. I don't know if maybe we mentioned it, but apparently I think the story is told by maybe Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, I'm not sure, or Reb Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Beis Halevi, on a train. There's some Jews. And there's a Christian missionary who is type of annoying these two Jews. They're peasants. They don't know much about theology.
Yeah.
And he's trying to convince them that to become Christian. So yeah. Rabbi Soloveitchik leans across the aisle and he says to the missionary, he says, listen, he says, Jesus could not have been Messiah. He says, why not? He says, because the Gemara, the Talmud says he wasn't. So the missionary says, that's your argument? He says, yeah, exactly, yeah. The Gemara says he wasn't, so obviously he wasn't. So the missionary says, what? The Gemara was wrong. What? The Talmud was wrong. So Reb Chaim, Reb Soloveitchik says, the Gemara was never wrong. He says, what do you mean was never wrong? He says, exactly, it was never, ever wrong. So the missionary, getting very frustrated, he says, how can you say it was never wrong? They said Bar Kochva was the Mashiach. They said Bar Kochba was the Messiah, right? And they were wrong. Rav Soloveitchik says they were right. He was the Mashiach. So the missionary says, how could he be the Mashiach? He was killed by the Romans. Rav Soloveitchik says, oh-ho. Oh-ho. Right. But aside from the humor in this, I love this. One of my favorites, right? Yeah. Soloveitchik jokes, they're always so
they're learned.
Very. But aside from that, I think he was saying something profound, that there was that halachically speaking, Bar Kochba was Chezkat Mashiach. Halachically speaking, it was completely correct to follow him as Mashiach. That's why Rabbi Akiva did it, because there was an assumption. He wasn't a false Messiah. He failed. There's a difference between a failed and a fake.
Right.
Right? I have a book here. This book is called Mashiachai, False Messiahs and Their Opponents. It is 600 pages or so, over 600 pages. So we had a lot of these false messiahs. I think what Rav Soloveitchik was saying is Bar Kochba was not one of them.
But they do call him Bar Koziva.
Yes. In the end, it was a deception. But
yeah.
At the time,
yeah,
Chezkat Mashiach. So you know, again, you know, in the prayer for the state of Israel, which was composed by Rav Yitzhak Isaac Herzog, chief rabbi of Israel, tremendous Torah scholar, together with the Sephardi chief rabbi, Rav Benzion Chai Uziel, I think it was at the time, and together with the help of the Nobel Prize-winning author who was religious, Shmuel Yosef Agnon.
Shai
Agnon, they put it together. I just bought a siddur. Tell you about this?
No.
It is a siddur in which I just got the Shabbos part, but the person who compiled this found the oldest manuscripts of every single prayer that he could find, and he has a facsimile of them in the siddur.
Cool.
Together with the sources and you know, historical discussion about its origin. So I'm reminded because it has that.
Can you use it? Or it's just like a coffee table book?
You can use it. You can use it, but it's a little unwieldy, but you could use it. He designed it so it could be used. It's fascinating. So it has actually Rabbi Yitzhak Isaac Herzog's handwriting with that prayer for the state of Israel in it.
Uh-huh.
It has Karibon Olam.
Yeah.
The original handwriting of the author of Yisrael Najara.
Seriously.
Totally readable. It has all the oldest manuscripts, like some Tehillim that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's got that. It's really quite amazing. Anyway, in that prayer, Rav Herzog called it Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. It was a very, some find that very controversial.
Yes, there are those who do find that controversial.
So many, many shuls, including ours, say Shetahei Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, which is a prayer. It should be the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. It was a hope and a prayer that that's what it should be. Again, you know, I understand, I remember our good friend, good friend whose name I just forgot, but close, just like that, man. Right, yeah. Jeff from South Africa.
Right, yes, Bear.
Jeff Bear. Jeff Bear.
Yaakov Bear.
Yaakov Bear, Yaakov Bear, who was very close to Rabbi Yashuv.
Very close.
Used to drive him around all the time. See, he once asked Rabbi Yashuv, he says, is this the beginning, is this the Tzmichas Geula? So Rabbi Yoshua says, I don't know, but I do know it's the end of the Golus.
Nice.
That's like a subtle distinction at which I'm not clear on what it means.
Right.
But, but you know, I think the idea that Jews have, that there is a kibbutz goli, so it's hard to argue. Yeah. There's been an ingathering of the exiles. There is a, and I remember Ramosha talking about the idea that there's a framework of sovereignty. There's a framework of a government in Israel. There's a framework of settlement in Israel, agriculture, economics, etc. Yeah. It's like, I remember having a discussion once with the Lubavitcher, and he said to me, he says, you know, we all say we believe that Mashiach could come any day, anima, right? Yeah. He says, but if you don't have a candidate, hard to say that with sincerity.
Yeah.
He says, so you guys don't have a candidate. We do. Is when the Rebbe was alive. He says, we have a candidate.
Yeah.
So that's actually not a bad point. You know, to have it. And I think with many Hasidim, they believe that they're Rebbes. I don't, probably deep down, they don't advertise about
it. There was a rumor that Baba Sali said that Mashiach was born and he's a Taimani or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Just full disclosure, I'm a Levi, so I cannot, can't be Mashiach. Okay. On the other hand, you could be. You're not a Levi, are you?
That's your way of putting me down. That is such a...
But how's that?
Say, you're not a Kohen
or a
Levi.
Be. You could be a Mashiach.
So you're like in the lottery, like of the...
There you go.
The 15 million Jews that are not
Kohen or Levi. I wouldn't put everyone in the same boat.
You are like... You have the same chance as anybody else has to be it. You won't be...
You're inferring incorrectly. I was just saying that that aspect is not standing in your way.
You're a non-Levi or Kohen.
You could be. I cannot be. Okay. Anyway, so those were some of the ideas we wanted to.
I want to add one thing.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I want to add one thing to that point, to this discussion that we're having, where I guess part of the direction I was going in as well, I mean, but it was all part of this, is that recognizing that it's possible is necessary. It's a necessary step. In other words, believing that we can be redeemed is a necessary step to being redeemed. I remember, I think it's a Maharal. I once heard this from Michal Tversky. It may be a Maharal. When Moshe Rabbeinu, it says Moshe, when he's leaving Yisro, he's going to go to lead the Jewish people. He's going to Mitzrayim. So it says that he put his family on top of the donkey. And he and his family ride down to Mitzrayim on a donkey. So there's a chazal somewhere that says that same donkey, that's the donkey that Avraham saddled when he was going.
Rashi
quotes that medrash.
When Moshe Rabbeinu is Vayarkivem, it says Vayarkivem al Hachamor.
Hachamor.
The donkey. So Rashi right there says, that's the donkey of Avraham. That's the donkey of the Mashiach.
Right. So it's a donkey of Mashiach. So I think it's a Maharal, but anyways, Rabbi Tversky explained was that by coming riding your donkey is an expression of what freedom looks like. And you cannot be a free person if you're not in control of your material self.
Maharal, right? Yeah, that's Maharal.
Right. You're so, and that's symbolized by riding your donkey. Moshe's coming down. He's sort of with his family riding on that donkey to send that message. Mashiach's going to come riding on the donkey to send that message. But I was suggesting it's not just to send the message, but to show it. Because when you see it, you can do it. In other words, remember the 4-minute mile. Once somebody saw that somebody can run a mile in under 4 minutes, suddenly other people were able to do it. It's not simply the lesson that you need to do this, but demonstrating it. He's showing it. See? And it's not just him, it's his kids, his wife. They're all on the so that seeing it. And what you're saying is that we're seeing it. You don't have to believe in it like it's some distant notion that Yeshua can happen. It's happening. We're looking at the elements in it. We're in it. We just need to just get to this point where we fully believe we can do it. And then, you know, obviously cry out to Hashem for salvation, but we need to, and to me, one of the painful things about the last year and a half was that, you know, there's a movie that came out October 8th.
I did not see it, but I plan on it.
Yeah, it's around, and you know, people are talking about it. And what's painful to me is I have friends who just think that's the most important movie that's come out in a long time. And I'm not saying that it's not important to, you know, to show people anti-Semitism, but to me, if I was going to make a movie about October 8th, the thing I would focus on is the sense of unity of the Jewish people on October 8th and 9th and 10th and 11th and 12th. We were all beating with one heart. We were beating with one heart. And the Gemara says that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of sinas chinam, unwarranted hatred, and the suggestion is that we're not going to be worthy of Mashiach if we have sinas chinam. In other words, that's what destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. We want to fix it. So, and you could hear people would say, well, you know, it's just not believable that we could have the unity that you're talking about. It's just not believable. But we had it. We did have it. We had it for days, we had it for weeks. We had it. We saw it. We saw what it looks like.
And I think also we had hope, optimism.
Yeah.
Which is shocking considering the circumstances.
Yes.
Right? That we had hope. We had that was widespread.
Yes.
It was widespread. The idea of optimism. I mean, there are philosophers who believe, Alvin Plantinga, that optimism is evidence for God, for belief. There's fact that humans have any optimism whatsoever. Right? Why do we imagine that things will be better at some point in the future? People have this idea, oh, it'll be fine. In Israel, you ask someone, Ech Mayir, what is the response is always?
Yeah, tov,
it'll be good. What? On the basis of what? Statistics? What are you? Yeah. Right? But there is this optimism and hope.
Yeah.
That the Jewish people have, and that people in general have.
Yeah.
But considering but if you the ask circumstances them, of the Jewish so people, we it's, just, it's shocking.
Yeah, we need, we're letting, I remember after the Iraq war, you know, the first one.
Yeah.
And Ramosha said, I remember he was lamenting, where he said, we're like a kli shavur, because we had it. And then it's just dripping out. It's like dripping out through the cracks. But we see it. We see. This is the thing that many people would tell you, it's not possible. It's not possible. Two Jews, three opinions. It's not possible that you could have the kind of unity that they were talking about that would be, you know, a necessary prerequisite for the Yeshua. But we had it. We can do it. We can do it. But we have to. Just commit to it.
If I remember correctly, I think it may be in the book. I have a couple of books about the samurai. So in one of them, they point out that one of the things that the armies, samurai army leaders would do is they'd construct an elaborate model of the fortress that they were about to conquer, etc., and show little models of their the warriors overcoming the other warriors, right, and conquering the fortress, and the warriors would see this,
yeah,
as a means of they'd see themselves doing this conquest.
Exactly.
So it's still done today, but primarily to indicate where people should go. Although there may be
athletes do an officer visualization.
If you speak to an officer in the army about when they construct these models and show, right, is part of it the psychological impact?
Yeah.
Or is it just so they know where to go, et cetera? But that's certainly part of it. If we can see it, it's there. So okay, so that was a little bit of an intro, some stuff about Exodus and when I remember when I visited Egypt, type of the pyramids were almost certainly there before the Jews were in Egypt.
Right.
But I can imagine they're awe-inspiring even today.
Yeah.
The tallest building in the world for about 4,000 years was the Great Pyramid at Giza. It wasn't until I think the Eiffel Tower was built, which was what, 1800s or something like that became the tallest building. So you can imagine you're a small group of people coming from Canaan, you come into Egypt and you see the power of Egypt. You see the pyramids.
Yeah.
The Nile,
yeah,
which is an impressive river. You see Egyptian culture, the pomp and circumstance of the pharaohs, the chariots, right? You think it's over.
Yeah.
You would imagine they didn't, right? Yeah. They believe. And of course, now here I am, with some kosher tour group, listening to classical music, watching a laser show at the pyramids, going back to the hotel and having, as you said, stuffed cabbage on the Nile. Oh, there is something to legacy kosher tours. Yeah.
Yes.
So they do sometimes have local cuisine, which our chef makes, but and the food's fantastic. But it's
fantastic. Tough.
Yeah. It is but I remember I think we were together in India.
Yeah.
On one of the legacy kosher tours. Yeah. And we were in New Delhi, I think.
That would be at the end.
It was the end. And I love stuffed cabbage. They had stuffed cabbage. I love curry even more, but you know what?
Get a choice.
Most of the people do not like curry.
You went through a curry stage, by the way. I remember that in Mishkan HaTorah.
I still like curry.
There was a period of time.
I was putting curry on everything.
Yeah, you're putting curry on everything.
I bought curry and the food, I put curry on everything.
Yeah.
So I still like Indian food. There are a couple of, every now and again you get a kosher Indian restaurant.
Yeah. St. Louis. Remember we went together.
Yes, we went to together.
All you can eat brunch at in St. Louis.
Excellent.
Gokul or something. Yeah. Gokul.
I think I was driving I got an upgrade, a large white Cadillac from the car rental.
Yes. I believe you were.
They gave me an upgrade. I was
Yeah.
I was a little nervous just about leaving it, parking it.
But not nervous to go at that buffet, Mordechai. You did a good job on it. Our money's worth.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, I think they lose money when I go to But anyway, okay.
All right.
So, Chag Sameach to everyone.
Chag Sameach.
If you like this, please tell your friends. Subscribe. Press like buttons or whatever it is, little thumbs up, etc. And so on. I'm not sure why that, because in Rome, that was an indication they wanted the guy to be killed. But okay, whatever. Nowadays, I'll accept the colloquial meaning, which is okay. Right. Yes. Give us the thumbs up and please recommend it to your friends. I think people might gain from our podcast. I enjoy it.
Yes. I certainly enjoy it.
We both enjoy it. That is good to have that confirmation.
Yes.
And I know that some of our family enjoys it.
Yes.
I don't think my
family. Most of our, I'm pretty sure most of the people that watch this video are our family.
There you go. Okay.
There you go.
So tell your friends and goodbye. And Chag Sameach. Have a wonderful
Chag Sameach.
Kosher Pesach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Kosher Sameach.